The psychiatrist is in, Greg Wyshynski. Now, okay. Greg, get on the couch. Make yourself comfortable. Take off your shoes. Are you relaxed? Are you feeling okay?
I am as relaxed as I can be on the air.
put your head back now. Go to your happy place and tell Dr. Merrick what the problem is today. We have a full hour here, a full hour of therapy. It's all paid for. Don't worry about that. Clear your mind of any other thoughts other than what's troubling you right now, Greg Wyshynski.
I think my main problem is we have a culture of equivocation. And here is what I mean by that, Dr. Merrick. I don't like the fact that every time a Democrat comes on CNN, there needs to be a Republican on CNN as well to balance the views. I don't like that there has to be peanut butter with my jelly. You know, if I just want to have a jelly sandwich, so be it. Why does there need to be peanut butter? I don't like the fact that every time there is a play at a hockey game that is clearly, say, like a blown call, just for shits and giggles, let me throw this out here. Say a guy gets a breakaway on an offside play that isn't whistled down. Yeah, let's just say the game's like 3-0. It's maybe like the first game of a quarterfinal series. He gets a breakaway, he scores a goal, changes the complexion of the game. Now, clearly, one team has been given an advantage here, right? Anyone with a functioning pair of retina can see that, right? So when you point that out on, say, Twitter, let's just use that as the social media medium of choice. When you point that out on Twitter, you expect people to say, yeah, you know what, that was bullshit. Or if you are, say, a fan of the team that was given the benefit, let's say it's the Flyers, for example, you expect Flyers fans to be like, yeah, woo, wipe the brow, we got away with one there. But we did deserve to win the game because we scored 3 goals after that, upset the Penguins on home ice, took game 1 of the series, took home ice away. It was a fantastic time, but yeah, boy, we were given the benefit there. No. Instead, because we have a culture of equivocation, we have to be told, well, what happened was they didn't call icing on the Dupree goal, so Dupree scored, and so this is just our comeuppance. It's all evened out. They got a goal, then we got a goal. No, you morons! You were given a breakaway! Do you understand how many other pieces have to fall into place to score after an icing is broken up? If they blew that call, great, fine, they blew the call. By no means is one equal to the other. One is a breakaway, one is a penalty shot, the other one's an effed up icing. Come on!
And you know
so
what?
The other, yes, sir. Please, doctor.
Well, I was just gonna say, no, calm down. You're getting worked up. You're not here to get hysterical. We're here to get at the root of your problem. I personally think you didn't get enough hugs when you were younger, but you know what? That's fine.
Might be true.
That's fine. Yeah. All right. We can get over the course of this podcast, over the how many years we do it, we'll finally get down to the essence of what is Greg Wyshynski. But in the meantime, you know what? Really, here's the thing about the and this sort of dovetails into another issue that I want to get into on today's program, which is the culture. You talk about the culture of equivocation. I'll talk about the culture of outrage, which seems to exist. And let's just use Twitter as the handle of choice, or the social media of choice. I've had it. It's boring. Did Shea Weber get away with one yesterday? Sure did. $2,500 fine if you missed it for Shea Weber for ramming Henrik Zetterberg's head into the turnbuckle. No, wait, into the glass yesterday at the end of the Detroit Red Wings Nashville Predators game. The outrage is predictable, and to this point now, Wish, I think the outrage is boring more than anything else. Like, this is a game where people are going to get away with things. This is a game where people are going to get hurt, and this is a game where you may expect justice, but you don't get it. Instead, you get just ice. That's what the game is. All right. If you see, I always, and there are plenty of people out there on Twitter who live. We've talked about this before. Live to be outraged. Live to be shocked. Live to be disappointed. To which point, I always say, it's okay if every now and then you're upset at a call, or a lack of suspension, or something went awry and you don't like the outcome of it. Every now and then, you know, I think it's healthy for you to have that feeling. But if this happens to you over and over again, like, I'm going to encourage everyone to do this. Go back and read your own Twitter feed. And if it's full of outrage and shock and disappointment, I'll say this. Get in a therapy room with Greg Wyshynski and ask yourself, why are you putting yourself through this? Why do you choose to do this for yourself other than the fact that it somehow makes you feel morally superior? that this is a sort of ethical lift for a lot of people as they measure themselves off against what they consider to be a horrendous and heinous sport at times. To me, the culture of outrage is boring and a little bit, when I really think about it and really chisel down to it, Wish, a little bit pathetic, because it speaks more to the people that are outraged consistently about the sport than it does about the sport itself.
Let me put you on the couch for a second, because here's where I think the culture of outrage comes from. Essentially, sports are entertainment. I know that really pisses off a lot of people who write these incredibly socially relevant stories and features and try to elevate sports into something more than it is. A guy like Brian Gumbel, for example, who I don't think has actually enjoyed a sporting event for the better part of the last 50 years. Sports are entertainment, so what happens is when the entertainment of going to the game and cheering and booing and feeling the emotions of the ebb and flow of a hockey game, let's say, when that is not enough, then what you want to do is get into the other aspects of the game, of the emotional components of the game. And by that I mean, you know, reading a post-game quote and getting pissed off about some guy disrespecting your team.
Being outraged
over a decision the National Hockey League made to suspend or fine a player. These are all just different facets of the same experience, which is feeling some kind of an artificial emotion while watching an entertainment a form of entertainment. That's all it is. So all of these things to me are offshoots of the bigger grand scheme, which is that we are all trying to be entertained. And how we choose to be entertained, as you pointed out, can vary from person to person. If you're cool watching a game, shutting off the TV and going to bed, that's fine. But there are so many fans now that the rest of it is so much a part of the actual game itself. You know, going on Twitter, going on Facebook, going on blogs, talking about these things. It's become a 24-hour Truman Show-esque form of entertainment, and we're all a part of it. Now, what's changed is two things, I think, over time. First off, the media itself has become histrionic and hyperbolic, and it started with sports talk radio, and it bled over to the newspapers, and then it became such a media saturation culture that everyone had to scream and yell or get on the tallest soapbox they could in order to get noticed. So what happens now is that when something happens in a game, and we're on Twitter and we're watching it, the same usual people are running in the opposite direction to be as contradictory as possible because they want to get attention. The other thing that's happened is social media. Everybody has a voice. Everybody has a chance to have their say, be it on Twitter, Facebook, a blog comment, a newspaper commentary. Everyone has a chance to say something. And this was not always the case, but now it is. And so what you get is things like today with Bob McKenzie on Twitter. Bob McKenzie's got 339, by the time you read this, probably 340,000 followers. Can you imagine that, Merrick? 340,000 people or porn bots or advertisers following Bob McKenzie.
He has more people following him and reading him now just on Twitter than he did when he was the editor-in-chief of the Hockey News.
Right.
Let that sink in for a sec.
So what McKenzie did today was he kind of went into a bit of a network thing. He kind of became Peter Finch from Network, and he's mad as hell. He's not going to take it anymore. And so what he writes is this: a couple of things, then time to do some real work, because contrary to what some think, Twitter isn't actually my job. People here getting increasingly vile, vulgar, out of control, not even bothering to block anymore, just won't even look at mentions. Don't offer up much opinion on Twitter because 140 characters doesn't cut it, and to be honest, I'd rather inform than rail. Opinions, especially like Twitter, are like anal orifices. He means assholes. Everyone has one, and some are larger than others. If you want outrage, anger, vitriol, you're in the wrong place. You have plenty of other options, plenty. Weber should have gotten one game. So what? I was more interested last night in telling you why he shouldn't get suspended than why he should. If you saw my tweets last night watching TS, you know, for a guy who says he's got other things to do than Twitter, this guy writes an F-load a lot on Twitter, you wouldn't know how unlikely the Weber suspension was, how likely Bitt's suspension was. That's my job. Or I suppose I could yell or be outraged or angry or be a parasitic troll who creates Twitter wars to be in the center of attention. No thanks. Now, what Bob McKenzie is addressing here obviously is the cesspool that Twitter and social media can be, and blog comments, and newspaper comments. Dude, I've been writing Puck Daddy since 2008. My skin is thicker than an effing turtle shell because of what's written about me in the comments. It has to be. It's the way of the world. But where Bob McKenzie is wrong is here. His problem is he's no longer insulated. His problem is that through social media, by using Twitter as a news outlet, as a way to break news, as a way to cultivate 340,000 readers, he has opened himself up to criticism in a way that he never has before. He's opened himself up to interaction in a way that he never has before. And you know what? He's running away from it because he just realized who his audience is, and it scares the shit out of him.
But everyone has that same audience. Like, that's the thing. These are all the same people. Like, a lot of the same people that follow Bob McKenzie also follow Greg Wyshynski, also follow Jeff Merrick, also follow Nick Kiprio, Sarah Millard, right down the
and
line.
And I hear
like
this, from them.
These,
I heard
these
from
are the
them
people
last
that are...
I had some guy tell me that called me a bitch and a pussy and an F-tard or some shit because I thought Danny Briere was offsides. I hear it too. The difference is that I've been in this mess for the last 15 years as a guy who wrote on the internet, came up through the internet, and understands that this is what happens on the internet. Bob McKenzie, God bless him, has been the editor of the Hockey News, has been a TV personality on TSN, and has been insulated from all of this. So when I see Bob McKenzie or Bruce Arthur or any of these guys that sometimes go on these rants about social media and how vile and disgusting the debates are and how vile and disgusting the comments are, who do you think is watching TSN? Who do you think is picking up the National Post? You're insulting your audience. This is who watches hockey. It's not everybody, but it's a lot of people. And it scares them. It frightens them to look out there and realize what it is the media, the hockey media and hockey itself has helped create.
Do you not think, though, at the same time, there is an enormous culture of the enrage? There are people that just consume. And by the way, your point about sports and entertainment is bang on. I am firmly, and I've always felt this way, there should be no such section in the newspaper called sports. It should be in the entertainment section. Reviews of hockey games should be right beside reviews of the latest movie release. Essentially, there is no difference when it comes right down to it. But don't you think more so than ever, the culture of people that look to be offended are ruling the day and are carrying the conversation?
You're right, because and it speaks to what you talked about yesterday, which is the culture of apology. And you know, the outraged are the ones that lead the conversation now. And because of that, there needs to be all this reaction to it.
You see, I just don't know where that change happened. Where did that change happen? Or where it all comes from, really? Because, I mean, and I always say this to people that, you know, freak out on Twitter about, you know, the Shea Weber incident. I got plenty of them last night. I'm just gonna have like a stock and I'll just copy and paste my answer back to everyone. Do you get this offended when you vote? Like, do you get this angry when you vote? Like, that's where real anger should happen, where you can actually affect change. I've never understood the concept of getting like life and death angry, where you see sports fans like beat up and pummel a police officer and his son after a hockey game. I've never understood where the anger comes from. I understand being emotionally invested in your team. I just don't know where the anger comes from. I don't get it, Wish. I have no clue where it comes from.
I do, because
these
things are touching us in a very emotional, basic Neanderthalic place. I mean, when I used to go as a kid to a Devils Rangers game, and I used to see a fight in the upper deck, I never questioned why it happened. I knew why it happened. The emotions that are in that building, the pressure cooker, the feeling that you're defending your own turf or that you're defending your own masculinity or whatever it is, all of these things come from this entertainment expenditure that we're all involved in. I never questioned. I know where it all comes from.
You know where I think a lot of it comes from? This is where I've gleaned, and this is where, you know, there is such a symmetry, and the symmetry is all BS too, because I hate the way both behave this way. A lot of it comes from the war metaphors we use for sports. Like the way, and I try to go whenever I like write teases or talk about this on, about hockey on either the radio, here on the podcast, or on television, I always try to go out of my way not to use war metaphors. Ever. Because what war forces you to do, by necessity almost, is you have to dig in your heels, and right or wrong, you have to defend your turf, period. Even though you know it is wrong, like in your heart, you know it is wrong, you have to defend. And that goes back to your original point about, you know, complaining about the Danny Briere goal and relating it to the icing with the Pascal Dupuis goal. It's refusal to look at yourself and look at your situation clearly, rather choosing to use a war motif of, you know, support the troops, defend the troops. That's exactly what it, that's what I've come down to. That's where I find a lot of that comes from. And that's where I see sports really doing, this idea of sports really doing a disservice, because the sports section is closer to, you know, international events than anything else, namely war, rather than being, you know, in a, existing in a realm where it should live. And would be most, I think, helpful for culture and, listener, helpful for you too and your sanity and your family's sanity. And that is under the umbrella of the entertainment page and the entertainment section.
I'm tired of the clutch the pearls, puritanical reactions to things. I'm tired of somewhat like Craig Button just mentioned on Twitter, the McKenzie thing, and talking about how, you know, debate should be elevated and let's all keep this thing on, keep discourse within decorum and all this bullshit.
Good luck. Good luck.
You're talking about hockey on the internet. What the F did you think was going to happen? The Lincoln-Douglas debates? What are you, a moron?
And this is what I keep saying about people that are outraged, like wizened media people, right, that have followed the game for years, if not decades, still, I don't know if it's feigned or legitimate, being outraged about what happens in a hockey game. This is the sport. Well, this is what
it
is.
Listen, that's why last night, I mean, the big story last night, which we promise we'll get to the on the ice stuff. The big story last night was the Weber thing, which resulted in a fine. But the second biggest story happened off the ice, and it happened on Twitter. And it was the Los Angeles Kings official Twitter feed.
Awesome.
Trolling the Vancouver Canucks, saying that they had just won, and the rest of Canada can celebrate that victory. That was such a beautiful thing, and it was clever, and it was what everything the playoffs should be, snarky, we're better than you, nanny nanny boo boo kind of thing. And there were actually people outraged over the fact that it came from an official Twitter feed. And I'm thinking to myself, there's going to be a guy who probably loses his job because he had the moxie to call Ryan Kessler a diver and put out that tweet last night after the game. And you know what? It made me feel good about our society in a second, for a millisecond, that a lot of people stepped up and said, dude, it's a Kings Twitter feed. It's hilarious. Leave him alone. But then my soul was crushed when I read Dave Schultz in the Globe and Mail writing about this thing as if it was like communication from the White House, where we had to reach out to the LA Kings and find out if there was going to be any sort of supplemental discipline for Kings Twitter guy because of what he did last night. We're actually there. We reach out to the Kings and be like, so the guy who went on Twitter last night and made a joke about Vancouver, has he cleaned out his desk yet?
You know what? You know what sports would be so much better. Okay, first of all, everybody calm down. This is only game one of the playoffs. A lot of stuff, more stuff's going to happen tonight. Everybody calm down. I just wish, and I'm one of those guys because I can't do it because it either gives me a headache or puts me to sleep. I just wish more people would smoke weed. I really just wish more people would get high and relax. And I wish I could do that too. I really do, man. I wish I could smoke pot. I really do, but man, I just can't handle it. But I wish there was something that could replicate that effect for everybody come playoff time. Everyone just chill out. Just
hey,
relax,
man.
Everybody.
Man, this is a total makeup for Briere not getting called in at offsides before. Who's Briere?
Is that the cheese you put on that cracker you gave me last night, dude? Is that what that is? Man, that stuff is awesome. You got any more? Oh, the caddy.
Why aren't you?
Oh, man.
Wait, what is this game? Why aren't we watching Doomsday Preppers? I love that show, by the way.
Hey, you know what? Here's when we should get to the intro. We should mention Joe Haggerty, a couple of our favorites on the show today. Cassie Campbell-Pascal and Joe Haggerty are on the program. But one point I do want to make, you know, in the intro, and I think Elena's kind of jigged it a little bit for today, having a little fun with us, and that's effing awesome because so is she. You know the Ilya Bryzgalov quote, you know, that I have after my name on the intro to the podcast. One, it's funny because it's Ilya Bryzgalov, but you know what? I agree with him. Like, that's the one quote that Bryzgalov has dished out that I really completely believe in. Why do you have to
What,
be
that you
angry?
Can be punished in China for killing a tiger?
Well, I do believe in that too. No, but you know, why do you have to be angry? It's only a game. It's only sports, guys. You know, let's just all take a step back and relax out of all this. You know, like there's no need. There's no sane reason.
We have a fundamental disagreement on this because I think being you think being upset is a bad thing. You think it's something that, you know, why you have to be mad. I will be the versus in this conversation because I think you have to be mad if you're a sports fan because it's all part of the reason that we're doing this. I really do.
All right. In the meantime, do I get to throw the intro today? In the meantime and in between time, as Ed Whelan used to say, formerly the voice of the Calgary Flames and also Stampede Wrestling in Calgary, in the meantime and in between time, Wish, let's hit the intro.
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
Playoffs? We'll talk about playoffs.
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
You kidding me? Playoffs?
Debate hockey, pop culture,
and more
hockey. Merrick versus Wyshynski.
And I love this, in true Merrick versus Wyshynski spirit, Elena Pagliarello, our producer, did it a day late. Should have been at the beginning of the playoffs. Nah, too much to do yesterday. I'll do it for the second day. That is the spirit of this show.
This is from Aaron Cozen's PhD, because we have some smarties listening to the show.
Ooh.
I wonder sometimes if the anger surrounding sports is somehow a manifestation of the ineffectual anger people feel in other parts of their lives. The ability to affect change in today's world, I think, seems so impossible for most people that they channel their anger, righteous indignation towards sports. Possibly am I overthinking this a bit, but I do think the trend of outrage, real or feigned, on the internet, especially regarding sports, speaks to a lack of other forum in their life to express those types of emotions. And dude, the LA Kings Twitter thing was gold. It's effing sports. That kind of chirping is delicious. Aaron makes two good points right here, real quick. Yeah. One, she's right, and we're right. Sports is an outlet. And you are bringing your day's work, your frustrations in life. If you feel like a loser, there's a chance your team can make you feel like a champion, if only for a day. All of that stuff is sports is an outlet through that, for that, without question.
But at the same time, too, it's a dangerous spot to invest yourself completely and emotionally and define yourself and define your identity by, I'm a Ranger fan, I'm a Kings fan, I'm a Canucks fan, and live or die by that.
Yeah,
because
that's true.
You're powerless to control it, and it can leave you very, very upset with a lot of emotions
true as well.
That ultimately get misplaced.
True as well, but her other point here is something that I wanted to mention before the intro, but I forgot. The manifestation of the ineffectual anger people feel in other parts of their lives, blah, 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 the ability to affect change. That's, to answer your question, Merrick, that's the reason why we see such an outrage culture, is because they know that they can change things. They know that if you beg hard enough for an apology and put enough pressure on sponsors or make enough noise or get enough people to retweet you or sign a petition, they know that they can get an apology or they can get someone fired. They know that this can happen because it's happened time and time again. So the floodgates are opened. The ability to affect change, be it putting pressure on the NHL to suspend somebody because you're bringing a play that they missed to light, let's say, or what have you, like, that's one of the reasons why we have a culture of outrage, because there is eventually some level of catharsis to it.
You know what? You referenced, and I'm glad you did, because it's one of my favorite movies. You referenced Network a couple of moments ago, and the Peter Finch character, Howard Beale, which is the great, you know, we always related with a mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. You know what, to me, the best line in that movie was, as delivered by that character, when he just looks at the camera and says, you know, at the end of, you know, the newscast before he's going to kill himself, and he just does a tight one-shot him, and everyone behind the glass, no one's paying attention. And he just looks at the camera and says, folks, I've just run out of bullshit. To me, that is the best line of that movie. Yeah. And I think everyone I think in sports, eventually you come around to that realization, like, what am I doing? Why am I getting myself so emotionally twisted and saying, why can't I just enjoy a sport for what it is? Why can't I just enjoy a game for what it is, for that matter?
I'm telling you, because outrage is part of the equation. Crosscheck Rays writes in, so Wyshynski calls BS on the elevate the argument, but then says, what the F? Back it up, Wish, just say, what the F? Well, listen. We can get away with some things in the show, but occasionally we have to draw a line because sometimes certain oh, let's say massive corporations that run things called iTunes will classify your programming as one thing when it's really something else if you happen to use enough of that language. So some advice may have been passed down. Some advice may have been passed down to myself and Jeff Merrick to not use certain words when we can just use a letter instead. So, yes, I stand by what I said.
Well,
but I also want you to be able to download the show without any kind of problem.
Well, and in that spirit, Wish, I think it's time we classed up the program. By bringing on our first guest, you watched her on Hockey Night in Canada. You've watched her, sorry, U.S. hockey fans, win gold medals in the Olympics. She is part of the inaugural Order of Hockey in Canada, joining Wayne Gretzky, Jean Beliveau, Gordie Howe, and Gord Renwick, who helped establish Hockey Canada. She is Cassie Campbell-Pascal, covering off the Rangers-Ottawa Senators series this evening for CBC's Hockey Night in Canada. She joins us now. Cassie, how are you today?
I'm great. Jeff, great. How are you guys?
Doing good.
We're trying to figure out where all the, you know, outrage comes from in sports, and this comes off of, and again, this is Twitter, so it's very unscientific, but you know, all the anger, all the venom, all the vitriol that seems to be out there, whether it's I don't believe in the Shea Weber fine, it should have been a suspension, or how could they miss the Daniel Briere call. I mean, you played the game, Cassie, and I'm sure you were, you know, part of, you know, the anger on the ice, and every player carries that with him or her, but from a fan's point of view, and you see this, I mean, you live in Calgary, so you know plenty of fan anger. Where do you think it comes from?
Well, I think it comes from passion. You know, I think, you know, from a player's point of view, if you don't have passion, you're not going to be successful. But if you have too much passion, you're going to make bonehead plays, you know. And I think that's, you look at Shea Weber and kind of what he did, and he's passionate. He wants the Nashville Predators to do well, and he knows that Henrik Zetterberg is one of Detroit's key players. And so the passion got the best of him, and, you know, he should have probably gotten a little bit more. And then you look at all the fans that have way too much Twitter courage sometimes, and, you know, they say stupid things, and it's about passion. And then, you know, for me, sometimes, not often, but I'll sometimes respond to a fan who's kind of been a little negative or quirky, and usually it ends up being a positive conversation because they get back to a level of passion that is realistic for their body to control, you know? And so then they're like, oh, okay, well, I kind of didn't mean it that way, and now I see what you're saying. And, you know, it's like, for me, the 24-hour rule. If I'm mad at something, I don't speak to people for 24 hours because I know I'm going to say the wrong thing. So it's just about managing passion, and it can be a good thing or it can be a negative thing for sure.
I've found that it's like about a three-email rule, that if somebody emails me about something they didn't like on the blog, And they really tear into me and just get personal and nasty and insulting, it takes about three emails of back and forth to have them come around and just sort of be like, man, you know, just leveled. You know what I mean? And not a complete jerk as they were before. But but when you see that on Twitter, though, you mentioned the whole outrage thing, and it gets kind of nasty and vitriolic. Do you think that's a mirror to society, or has that always been the sports fan?
Well, I think it's always the sports fan in general. And, you know, in our position, we write about hockey. You know, we write about the Senators, the Rangers, you know, Pittsburgh Penguins, whatever. And, you know, we grew up being fans of the game, and we maybe had our certain team. But now in our job, we're supposed to be unbiased, and we try to be, and we try to get all the stories, and we try to cover it that way. So if we write a story about the Pittsburgh Penguins, well, then the New York Rangers fans are just beside themselves, and or the Philadelphia Flyer fans, and you know. So I think, I honestly believe that some people think, in the regular world, so to speak, that us media people, you know, we just cheer for teams. We sit in our little blogs and our little things, and we cheer for teams, and it's really not the case. Like, we try to tell the story based on what we, you know, who we talk to, and you know, based on our conversations at the rinks. And and I think that's a big misconception out there, that, you know, I tweet about the Ottawa Senators today, well, then the New York Rangers fans are mad because I only, you know, tweeted twice about them, and I tweeted three times about the Rangers or the Senators. And it's like, well, I'm just tweeting information as I get it, you know. And so I think that's a big misconception out there too with the fans. And, you know, but it's hockey, right? And people are crazy about hockey, especially in Canada, and I think in the eastern United States, too, they're just as crazy, and we probably don't give them as much credit. And they love their teams, and they love their hockey, and so that's why I think we're all free game.
And as a player too, Cassie, I won't use the player's name in question, but feel free if you'd like. It's your story after all. I know that you drew a lot of, you know, when you speak about player anger from player to player, you drew a lot of inspiration from something that happened in Handshake Alley with you once when one player said, "Cassie, bitches never win." How much of a motivator was that? And if you'd like to say who the player was, by all means, go ahead.
Yeah, her name was Laura Baker, and she played for Team USA, and you know, they were kicking our butt in 2002 over and over and over again. And to me, it was just such an unnecessary thing. You know, it was just such an unnecessary comment. I think it was after Game 7. And, you know, we lost 8 times in a row to the U.S. prior to beating them the 9th time. And I heard her, and it was, like, so clear as a bell. And I thought to myself, why would you say something stupid like that? And it was just so uncalled for. So that's why I'm a big fan of, you know, don't give the other team's motivation, you know. And I remember writing it on big letters and putting it up in my stall, and it sort of carried with me, you know, bitches never win. And you know, of course, sure enough, we did. And I was so, you know, my teammates really wanted me to say something back to her after gold medal game. And I thought, you know what, no way. I have too much satisfaction right now. I don't want to ruin this moment by being just as dumb as she was. And, you know, I had too much satisfaction at that time with the gold medal around my neck. And, you know, she knew exactly what she said. And, you know, she probably didn't want to hear about it either. And, you know, that's why I'm a big believer in just, you know, when it comes to game, just keep your mouth shut and just do what you do on the ice. And the rest should fall into place.
There's really only one place where bitches win, which is the Westminster Kennel Club each year at Madison Square Garden, which evidently is where you're going to be for the Rangers and the Ottawa Senators series. Now, the interesting thing about the series, I think, is that had the Rangers drawn the Capitals, I'm pretty sure there'd be a few more people putting the Rangers over in a quick series because they match up well, because of the history. I feel like the insertion of the Ottawa Senators into the series has created a bit of mystery for some people, and actually have the Rangers in some cases being upset by the Senators in the 1-8 series. How do you see this thing playing out?
You know, I just have this feeling about the Ottawa Senators. You know, I think the Rangers' time to win the Stanley Cup is coming soon. Like, if they don't do it this year, I think they have a great opportunity to do it next year. And, you know, they might be like the Pittsburgh Penguins of recent, where, you know, they lose kind of 1 year to win it the next year, and they learn a little bit about themselves. And that's kind of how I see the Rangers. When I look at the Senators, I just get this eerie feeling about them, in the sense that I feel like they're playing for their captain. And I followed them. I did about 12 Ottawa Senators games this year, and Daniel Alfredson is so well respected. And I believe that if he's able to have a really long run with this team and, you know, potentially play in a Stanley Cup final, I wouldn't be surprised if he retires at the end of the year. And I think the players know that, and I think they want to do good by him and they want to play well by him. And, you know, they continue to deflect the pressure, and you know, they keep saying they're the underdog. And I really like that approach with them, and I think they're well coached. I think a lot of people are underestimating Paul McClain. I mean, he's won a Stanley Cup with Detroit as an assistant coach. You know, he's been there. I think he's missed 2 seasons as a player and a coach, you know, where he missed the playoffs. And he's just a really smart man. And I don't know. I just have a really good feeling about the Ottawa Senators. And I can be totally proven wrong, of course, with the Rangers just coming out and blowing them away. But it's just kind of a sense I have from covering the team that they can do some damage in the playoffs this year.
Cassie, as you mentioned, you covered a lot of Ottawa Senators games this year for Hockey Night. Where are you at with Erik Karlsson? And to your point earlier about, you know, the Rangers using this as a learning experience, I don't know that there's anyone in this series who stands to learn more about himself, his teammates, the game itself, than Erik Karlsson. Where are you on the young defenseman?
Well, I think he's going to face a ton of bodies. You know, you look at Pruss and Rupp and Boyle and Dubinsky, sort of the third, fourth line guys for the Rangers. I mean, I think any time they're on the ice with him, they're going to make it miserable. And, you know, and I still think that's something new for Erik Karlsson. I think during the regular season, as it went on, you started to see big bodies get on him a little bit more. But I still think the playoff part of it is really new to him. And, you know, I'm a big fan. I think he's a great skater. I think he's going to be a Norris Trophy winner for sure, if not this year, then many years to come. But I still think defensively he's got some liabilities and tries to do a little too much in his own zone. And And, you know, I still think there's a level of fitness that he needs to get to as well. And, you know, there are times where I watch him rush up the ice and maybe give away the puck, and then it's not so encouraging to watch him come back. He doesn't sometimes get back as well as maybe he should. And just some little inconsistencies in his game, and I'm totally, you know, picking at him because I think he's such an extreme talent. But I think there's just little inconsistencies in his game that I think you might see a little bit more in a playoff run like that starts tonight.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you about Carlson. You mentioned maybe the Norris this year, maybe in another year. So in other words, you think it's fair if he doesn't win this year. There's a lot of Ottawa fans that think he should have this thing in the bag based on the point total. But it's fair that if it goes to Weber or Chara, then it's okay then.
I think it's fair because it should be about a complete game to me. And, you know, I just think that you look at Chara and you look at Weber and they don't have the points that Carlson has, but they're playing against the top lines. They're shutting down guys. They're physical. They just have so many more elements to their game that Carlson doesn't have yet. And maybe Carlson will never be the guy that can shut down and play a physical game. I mean, he doesn't have the body type for that. But I think there's a completeness to those other two guys' names that you mentioned that Carlson just doesn't quite have. And so if he doesn't win the Norris, I still think it's fair. I still think he had a Norris Trophy type season. But I think it might be one of those things for him where he realizes I need to be not only a great offensive player, but I need to be complete. And you look at Lidstrom and Bob Orr and, you know, Dennis Potvin and guys who've won it before. I mean, they're complete defensemen. And I think that's the one thing that he, you know, he still has another 10 to 15% to go to be at that level.
Cassie, are you with me on this one? I see this series as the race to three. Whichever team scores the third goal first in this series is going to win the game.
Yeah, you know, I think that's an interesting point, Jeff. The goaltending still scares me. And I know Henrik has had such a great, you know, regular season, but I still think he's a beatable goalie. You know, I still think, you know, maybe not so much on the first shot, but if they can get guys in front and try to find a way to get inside the Rangers' defense. And I think the second shot has always been sort of Lundqvist's weakness. You know, he's great at, you know, being in the net, but then that next move to me. So I think that'll be interesting to see. And you know, with Craig Anderson, it's a little bit of a crapshoot. I mean, he's really only been in the playoffs once. And, you know, coming off an injury about a month ago, you wonder sort of, is he where he needs to be mentally, physically? You know, is he playing well? But I know that he's got the backing of Paul McLean. And you look at game one for Detroit, for Ottawa against Detroit at the start of the season, he could have easily pulled him. He didn't. Stuck with him. They allowed three goals quick. And then you look at the game where he came back from injury, played against Montreal, pulled him, but then immediately went back to him and put him back in. And I think that gave a guy like Craig Anderson a lot of confidence that the coach had his back. Alfredson also went to the coaches and said, hey, put him back in. We need him down the stretch. And so, you know, I think that is going to help him with a lot of confidence. But goaltending is still a question mark in this series for me. And I'm just curious to see if it's one goaltender like Anderson who just steps up and is unbelievable, and is it another goaltender like Lundqvist who maybe crumbles a little bit under the pressure here in New York?
Obligatory women's hockey question. So I'm in Washington, D.C. I was just asked by a reader, I'd say probably about 2 weeks ago, right when the NCAAs were going on for men's hockey, where the women's coverage was. And I tried to put into words why it doesn't get much coverage on Puck Daddy or in the U.S. hockey media. But I wanted to get your take. What needs to happen for women's hockey to get more attention in the United States, do you think?
Probably have to start taking our clothes off or something. No, I'm totally joking.
We would be so offended if that happened, ma'am.
How dare you, Cassie?
Well, I think we need it to not be a two-horse race. And, you know, that's been difficult for me to say now that I'm out. And, you know, when I was playing, you're defending it. But I think now watching from afar, you know, we need more teams internationally to step up and to take their programs to the next level. And, you know, the Russian Ice Hockey Federation should be appalled at the way they treat their women over there. You know, Finland and Sweden, who in the early days of women's hockey were always great, I mean, their federation should, you know, not be appalled, but they should really look at how they're supporting their female athletes. And So that's kind of, that side of it's been really frustrating. But, you know, what kind of bothers me is not so much the international stuff, it's the fact that our leagues don't get a lot of coverage. And you look at NCAA hockey and women's hockey, it's great. You know, you look at the Canadian Women's Hockey League, we have, you know, over 25 Olympians playing in that league, and it's great hockey. And, you know, we're lucky to get one game of coverage every year. And so to me, that sort of is disappointing that, you know, we don't get more coverage at those levels. And part of me thinks it's just because people don't know enough or don't know how good the game actually is. And so they're afraid to kind of cover something that they know nothing about. And so that's kind of been frustrating. And we need the support of the big networks, you know, the NBCs and the TSNs and the CBCs and the Sportsnets and all those people to just step up and give us a little bit of coverage and a little bit of page space on websites. And I don't think that's asking a lot. And yet in today's day and age, I think it's a necessity.
If for no other reason, guys, do it for your daughters so they grow up in that environment where they're supported. Cassie, last one for me. The Order of Hockey in Canada, joining Wayne Gretzky, Jean Beliveau, Gordie Howe, Gord Renwick as well, who, as I mentioned off the top, helped establish Hockey Canada. Did this one catch you as a surprise? And follow-up question, is this the warm-up award for the Hockey Hall of Fame for you?
Hey, now.
Well, you're my biggest supporter with that, Jeff, and I always appreciate it, but... You know me, I was actually on my way to New York, and I was just about to get on the plane, and Bob called me, and I had no sort of recollection that this award was being given out, and, you know, no thoughts on why I would be getting a call that day. And then he told me, you know, 5 minutes into the conversation who I'd be going in, you know, getting this award with. And, you know, and that was kind of the jaw-dropping experience for me, and I don't think I said anything to him for at least a minute. And, you know, it just was kind of overwhelming, and, you know, I'm obviously really excited for myself, and it's a great honor, but I think this is so huge that, you know, in the very first award for this, that women's hockey was included, and, you know, it could have been me or Angela James or, you know, whoever. That wouldn't have mattered to me. I think it's just a really neat experience to be included in that group, and it's going to be a great event on June 25th, and you know me, Jeff, I get just as much excitement watching. I remember I was pregnant when Cammy Granato and Angela James got into the Hockey Hall of Fame, and so I couldn't make the trip because I might have had my baby on the plane. But I know for a fact I was just as excited watching them if it would have been me. And so, you know, if one day I get in, that's fantastic. But for me, just to continue to see some of my idols, you know, get rewarded and get some recognition is all it's worth for me, and that makes it all more special for sure.
You're too humble. You belong in the Hockey Hall of Fame. Cassie, on that, we'll let you go. Congratulations on the Order of Hockey in Canada. Have fun with the Ottawa-New York Rangers series. We'll be watching you on Hockey Night tonight.
All right. Well, thanks, Jeff and Greg, and I look forward to being on with you guys some more down the road.
Abs-freaking-lutely. Thanks, Cass.
Bye.
Cassie Campbell Pascal, and you know what about Cassie and her family? Husband, who's the sort of second in charge of Hockey Canada. But the Bob she was referring to is Bob Nicholson, who's the head of Hockey Canada. Mm-hmm. The second in command is her husband, Brad Pascal. Had a minor league career, played with the Rochester Americans, most notably. When you start talking about like that next wave of general manager in the NHL, like that young sort of early 40s class of general manager, don't be surprised in the next couple of years you start to hear the name Brad Pascal thrown around a lot more. As he's one of those guys that sort of, we talked about, you know, Botterill a couple of weeks ago with the Pittsburgh Penguins, that then Julien Brisebois as well. Don't be surprised if the name Brad Pascal starts to come up more and more for how he puts together teams for Hockey Canada.
Sorry, for the last 5 minutes, I've just been running through my brain, Sam Jackson going, that's it! I have had it with these MFing babies on this MFing plane!
She actually had given birth.
Brooke Violet is their daughter's name.
That's a beautiful name.
A great kid. Yeah, I know. It's real nice. Real nice family there.
Revisiting the rant from the top of the show real quick before we get to Shea Weber stuff. This is from Chris Kraft. I absolutely love the beginning of the show. As a very avid Pens fan, I listened to Phil Bourque say that the goal was offside, and I thought, shit, how does that get missed? And then you call it a day. I'm fairly sure if you're a Pens fan and want to be mad, see Jordan Staal not have his head on a swivel, they need to calm down. As far as sports being entertainment, you couldn't be more bang on. You guys really need to listen to Greg Giraldo's stand-up called Midlife Vices, and there's a portion called Sports China when he talks about sports being so important to people. If you don't have the ability to get drunk and paint yourself orange and brown, you might think, shit, I live in Cleveland. I thought it was great. Keep doing such a great job, fellas, and cheers.
Hang on. Who is it? Greg? Greg Giraldo.
Yeah, he's,
what's the piece called?
It's called Midlife Vices. Might have been the stand-up special. All right, there you go. Shea Weber, sir. Shea Weber gets a fine rather than a suspension.
Yeah.
And it's an, you know, they whiffed on this one, and they know they did. And the just if you had to put a percentage on it, it's about 95% of people saying that they got this wrong, that he deserved at least a game. The justification for him getting a fine rather than a suspension goes like this.
No injury.
There wasn't an injury on the play, which, as you know, has been a very big thing. And when you get to the playoffs, there's a very big eye-for-an-eye standard for suspensions, without question. Mm-hmm. They thought that the punch that he whiffed on, the punch that he missed to the back of Zetterberg's head, was actually more egregious than grabbing Zetterberg's head and slamming it into the glass, because he's got a helmet on, he's kind of protected, it wasn't as bad. The other thing is that they didn't necessarily see the $2,500 fine that Weber got for boarding Yannick Hansen back in October as being a making this a repeat offender thing.
Yeah, shouldn't mainly be because in the conversation for this, yeah.
The boarding thing is a different thing than this thing. They're two different offenses. It's not like he didn't learn his lesson then. They don't see it that way. They see it as if you keep on doing the same thing violently, two headshots in a row, like Andy Sutton. Headshot on Landeskog, headshot on Ponikarovsky. Well, you've clearly not learned your lesson, and we're going to tag you. They don't see boarding and whatever the hell that was last night, turnbuckling, to be the same thing.
Turnbuckling.
So they've got a lot of justification for why there shouldn't have been a suspension, and a lot of it kind of fits in logically with what they've done. But as I said on Puck Daddy, I think the real disconnect for the Department of Player Safety and Brendan Shanahan is this. For 82 games, they were preventative. They were almost like a rehabilitation organization, where they would go and they would see plays and they would try to make examples of plays and say, you can't hit like this anymore, or you shouldn't hit like this anymore, or you need to be smarter about hitting like this. And then they'd go after guys like Dan Carcillo and Andy Sutton, the real miscreants, the guys the general manager said, look, you have to come down hard on these guys because it's this, you know, 10% of the players that are always getting in trouble. But now that we're in the playoffs, it's a different animal. Now that we're in a playoffs, it needs to be less about preventing things and more about punitive, more about punishment. And I'm sorry, what Shea Weber did at the end of that game last night is a one-game suspension in the regular season, in the playoffs, in the Stanley Cup final. It was intentional, reckless, and an embarrassment to hockey. He embarrassed hockey last night. You know how we know?
Wow.
Because John Laurinaitis, the vice president of talent acquisition for the World
Johnny Ace?
For World the Wrestling guy, Entertainment, tweeted out
that the guy that used to watch in All Japan Wrestling with Giant Baba? What?
Right. The interim general manager for Raw and SmackDown tweeted out last night that he would like to – he thinks Shea Weber has what it takes to be in professional wrestling. Now, Merrick and I love this, of course. We find it hilarious.
Now,
but the bottom line is that the GM of the WWE just called what happened last night a professional wrestling play, which will tell you all you need to know about it being an embarrassment to hockey.
All you needed was Shea Weber to do it like five times and then turn to the audience to have them start counting for the final five to make it to 10 and then have Henrik Zetterberg sort of do the wobbly guy back out into the middle of the ice and take a Ric Flair, Greg Valentine-esque face bump.
Do you agree that you understand why it's a fine?
Yeah.
But it should have been a suspension, right? Yeah? Are we on the same page?
I could see it being a one-game suspension, but I understand why they just gave him a fine. But this was also, and listen, we got note about this last night on Sportsnet after it happened, that this would not be a suspension, but this would be a stern warning, young man, that this type of behavior will be closely watched and essentially what they've done is they put Shea Weber on watch. It's like, we're going to throw you the max under the CBA, $2,500, and folks, that's where that number comes from. A $2,500 fine. That is a CBA issue. That is the most you can fine someone as collectively bargained between the Players Association and the NHL. But now they've put him on watch. That was almost as if saying, all right, you got your mulligan. You got your freebie. But now anything that comes close to the line, we're going to give you a suspension. And in the playoffs, as we've seen before, when there is a borderline call where there's something that could both be a suspension or not be a suspension, the NHL, when it comes to the playoffs, always errs on the side of no suspension. But I think now that Shea Weber's been put sort of on guard, sir, the next time anything comes close to that line, he'll get dinged.
What I
but
hate
I could,
about
I,
this...
I could see it being a one. I could see it being a one-game suspension. And my main problem with it, more than anything else, is it was when the game was over. Like, the game was done. This wasn't like in, oh, it's 14-32 and they're fighting for the puck. Like, the buzzer had gone. The game was done. Yeah. It was over. It's at that moment where, all right, that's it. It's done. Put your hands down. Go to your bench. It's over.
Right. I have a problem with this for two reasons. One, because if you are treating this like a warning for Shea Weber, well, then technically this is two strikes. He already got warned back in October. Don't play over the edge. Be smarter. Okay, this is two strikes. How many other players in the National Hockey League get that kind of leeway?
If this was Jordan Tutu that did this, then it would be different.
Yes, I am.
And not a superstar, Norris Trophy candidate.
And that's the second thing I hate about this, is I hate having to admit or see evidence to that point that there is a different standard for some players. I don't want to believe it. I don't want to believe that's the case. But there's no question that Shea Weber doing this, okay, one of the pieces that has to be considered is, do you want to take the best defenseman in hockey away from his team in a playoff game, up 1-0 against the Detroit Red Wings? And that decision is tied into whether or not you believe that the act is egregious to do that. And there's no question that that was part of the thought process, and it pisses me off that this guy gets two strikes while other guys get one, and it pisses me off that that thought has to enter into the process. Do we want to punish the Nashville Predators for what was essentially a moment of rage at the end of a game for a player that went over the edge?
In your mind, has Brendan Shanahan so far, and this is one day in the playoffs, made Colin Campbell look tough? Let's not forget, he sat down Chris Pronger at the height of Chris Pronger's powers, 2007. He sat him down not once, but twice during the 2007 Stanley Cup run when Chris Pronger, alongside, you know, Nick Lidstrom and Scott Niedermeyer, was the best defenseman in the game. Has Shanahan made Coley look tough?
Well, it's one of two things, and it really depends on how you feel about Shanahan. Either he's made Colin Campbell look tough, or he looks more thoughtful than Coley Campbell. Because remember, the overreaction we've seen before, Aaron Rome was an overreaction, right? If nothing else, maybe you come away with this believing that the current incarnation of the Department of Player Safety is going to be a bit more cautious and careful about overreacting to things. I mean, we had Red Wings fans last night saying, ban him for the series. Really?
Okay.
Only silver lining I take from this is that maybe they are a little bit more careful and considerate about the implications of what a suspension means in the playoffs. But at the same time, man, it also validates all that shit that we hate about supplemental discipline and about there being a caste system in it. If this was Max LaPierre last night,
oh boy,
banging the head of Andre Kopitar at the end of a game, ooh, come on.
Yeah, Kopitar would look up and say, do we have the five yet? Let's shift gears. Boston and Washington, Greg Wyshynski, on the horizon. Game one this evening. Joining us on the line, one of our favorites. You know him as Hacks with Hags on Twitter. He is our man, Joe Haggerty. He joins us now. Hags, how are you, sir?
Jeff, Wish, what's up, boys?
I'm curious.
Hey, Hags. Please, ask him.
Ask him.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to ask him about
Go ahead.
I don't know what you want me to ask him. I'm going to ask him about Shea Weber. We want to ask about the Boston Bruins. About Shea Weber. No suspension, Mr. Haggerty, but rather a fine for Shea Weber, to which Hacks with Hags says what?
I think in the playoffs, people are going to hate me for this and think I'm, medieval and everything else, but I kind of believe in the no harm, no foul sort of line of thinking that Brendan Shanahan has with some of these decisions. You know, he obviously waits to see what injuries arise from a lot of these, and sometimes, you know, things can look worse on video than they actually were in reality. I mean, to you and I and anybody else watching, it looked like straight out of the WWF, you know, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat slamming somebody's head into a turnbuckle. But, you know, if Zetterberg was okay and able to, you know, walk away from it fine, I think you'd, in the playoffs, you know, you give them a slap on the wrist, you say, we're watching you, and the next time you do something, you know, you're going to get hammered. And there's a superstar cast system, you're right about that. There's certainly a system in place where if your guy's not seriously injured, they're going to lay off on the punishment. And in both cases, I'm okay with it. You know, if you really seriously hurt a guy, as Aaron Rome did last year with Nathan Horton, then you throw the book at him. And I think that's the way it should be.
See, what I hate about all of this is that it just becomes such a tangled web of hypocritical bullshit whenever you start parsing out these debates. Because then how do you feel about that being established that you should, you know, kind of suspended the injury, eye for an eye kind of thing? How does that square with Marchand's suspension for Salo?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it that's where it becomes, there's a reputation thing and everything else. You know, obviously with Marchand, I think some of that was based on, you know, what he's done in the past and, you know, the fact that they know he's going to act up and they're trying to make an example out of him to quiet him down. You were there, Wish, when we were talking to Shanahan, and he said during the All-Star weekend, you know, there are some guys I talked to on the phone once during a hearing and say, we're never going to hear from that guy again, and there are other guys we talk to and say that guy's going to be a frequent customer. You know, and Marchand is certainly one of the latter rather than the former. So I would expect them to whack a guy like that pretty hard.
How do you see, stylistically, how do you see the Bruins Cap series playing out? Which is the, what type of hockey will we see tonight? Will it be dictated by the Caps and their style or the Boston Bruins and theirs?
That is such a magnificent question, isn't it? Because I don't even know what the Caps style is. You know, they're trying to be this defensive team, but their personnel tells you they should be a skill team that's trying to get on power plays and make other teams hurt because of that. And they should be playing to their strength of Ovechkin, Semin, Backstrom, Green, Weidman. Yet they want to play this, you know, knuckle-dragging defensive style of hockey, and everybody that I talk to seems to think that they want to win 2-1 against the Boston Bruins with a third-string goalie out of Hershey. That doesn't make sense to me. You know, I think the best way to beat the Bruins is to try to entice them into doing some stupid things, try to get them to take some penalties. They were they were only two teams that had more penalty minutes and averaged more penalties a game than the Bruins did this year in the NHL, and they get a lot more reputation calls against them, I think, than they used to because of the way they perform the playoffs and what people have seen out of them. And other teams should take advantage of that, and they did during the regular season. I thought those were the teams that had the best success against them were the ones that played that way and then could go on the power play, and if they have the firepower like Washington does, even though they didn't do it during the regular season, just hammer them. But, you know, I'm interested to see what's going to happen here. I'm also interested to see if the Washington Capitals play in the style of Dale Hunter, and we're going to see guys cheap shotting other guys during the series if things start to go bad for the Capitals. I think there are a lot of questions here, whether the Caps are having an identity crisis, what style they're going to play in, and how the series is going to play out. And it's going to be fascinating to watch because I don't even know at this point until they start playing tonight.
I really don't think it would be in the Washington Capitals' best interest when you measure off personnel to play the Dale Hunter, Pierre Turgeon style of game against the Boston Bruins.
Right.
They don't have those. I mean, you know, God bless guys like Matt Hendricks, but they don't have that type of personnel. God bless Jason Chimera, but that's not the Washington Capitals' way to play against the Bruins.
No, I agree, but they have Chimera, they have Brouwer, they have Hendricks. You know, they've got some guys that can play that way. Certainly they can't match up to the size and strength and the toughness that the Bruins bring to the table, and almost nobody can, but you know, you wonder how that's going to play out. You wonder why Ovechkin is skating with Brouwer and Brooks Lake rather than skating with Alex Semin. You know, you wonder what style that's going to sort of bring to the table there and what the plan is with them going with that kind of a look.
There's been a certain kind of myth-making quality to the Boston Bruins Stanley Cup championship last year where people forget that it wasn't exactly the easiest road getting there, right? And a lot of the reason they even played for the Stanley Cup was on the shoulders of Nathan Horton scoring some ridiculously big goals throughout the playoffs. So the question becomes, who inherits the mantle? Who becomes this year's Nathan Horton scoring the clutch goals?
Yeah, it's a good question. You're right. The last year, two of the biggest visions from the Bruins winning all those rounds and getting to the Cup Finals and winning were Nathan Horton in Game 7 raising his hands in celebration and Tim Thomas just absolutely mystifying opponents at every turn. And obviously Tim Thomas is there this time around, but as far as the Game 7 hero, the guy that scores the clutch goals, that's an interesting question. I think X-factor-wise, the forward that qualifies the best for my money would be Tyler Seguin, just because I think he's the biggest difference maker from last year to this year as far as making that team better. You know, the fact that he blossomed basically into a 30-goal scorer this year, an all-star forward, and a guy that tripled his point output for last year, really puts him in a spot where he can be a difference maker as far as a guy scoring goals, creating offense, making things happen. We all know he's not quite where he's going to be as a player when he fully develops, but he's really starting to get it, and he gets the battle in front of the net in the corners, and he gets what he has to do to score goals, moving without the puck, everything else. And I think he's the one force that they have that other teams are going to have a hard time finding an answer for consistently, that speed, that creativity. Now, the question is, does he have the balls to be able to do it in Game 7 with the game on the line, you know, in the last couple of minutes and do some of the things that Nathan Horton did, especially around the net? That remains to be seen. Lucic is obviously a guy that can step up in that regard, and he had a very bad postseason last year, and it feels like he has something to prove this time around, so... Could be him. Marchand, you know, he rises to the occasion as well. But I think it's either Lucic or Seguin that we're looking at as being a difference-making forward. But, you know, the Bruins story postseason-wise, as last year, I think begins, goes through, and ends with Tim Thomas.
And for my money, personally, I don't think anyone gets better Photoshop posters than Tyler Seguin. Hey, what's been the that was great.
He seems to have a nice hall of Playboy playmates that he's putting in his harem as well. There,
the boy, you've come a long way from the Plymouth Whalers, son. You've come a long way from the Plymouth Whalers. What's been the main difference between Tyler Seguin year in and year out? He just looks like such a profoundly different hockey player this year.
Some of it was the size and the strength. He gained 10, 15 pounds. He worked with Matt Nichol at BioSteel in the summertime, and he was much more diligent about it this year than last year. He said he was there basically all summer, whereas he did it for maybe 6 weeks between getting drafted and then going to that first training camp. So I think he was a little more confident just that he was going to be able to battle with guys and have some success, and he wasn't going to get killed going out into the action in the NHL. I think there was some wariness there when he was an 18, 19-year-old in that first year, and just afraid that if he put himself in a vulnerable position, or if he did certain things, that guys were going to take his head off. And I think he's kind of learned now that he can battle, he can fight back. There are certain things he can do to protect himself without trying to run people through the boards and through the glass. So that's part of it. And the other part of it is just confidence. You know, I think going through the playoffs last year, having that game against Tampa Bay where he absolutely exploded, and, had a lot of success and really helped the Bruins win a game and then played in the Stanley Cup Finals and got that experience as well. That helps the player grow. That was something he had never really had in junior hockey, and it's something the Bruins talked a lot about as the different sort of maturity scales that Taylor Hall and Tyler Seguin were all. Taylor Hall had had a lot of big, you know, world junior experience, postseason junior experience, had played in a lot of big stages. Whereas Seguin hadn't done that, and that was part of his development that they needed to help him along with. And, you know, there's no bigger stage than playing against Vancouver in the Stanley Cup Finals. And I think that really helped Seguin kind of get it as to how he does now.
And speaking of Vancouver, I think the Bruins have a talent for exposing teams. Like, they exposed the Buffalo Sabres as sort of a non-truculent team, and I don't think they were ever the same after that Lucic Miller thing. And I think the Bruins exposed the Canucks last year as the single most loathed team in all of professional hockey, and it seems to have carried over to this year. What is your take on now all of a sudden the LA Kings getting in on the trolling of the Canucks, and the Canucks just generally being the most hated team in hockey?
That really says something, doesn't it, when the Team Kings account, Twitter account, goes out and actively trolls there and, you know, it says the rest of Canada can thank them, everybody outside of British Columbia, for beating the Canucks. First of all, I think it's pretty brazen. They've only won one game in a 7-game series. So, you know, we'll see what happens when Carter and Richards decide to leave Dry Island and start having some fun as the series is going on. But as far as everything else goes, they absolutely have brought that to light. And I was as surprised, to be honest with you, as everybody else was when I started hearing that at the beginning of the series. I watch every once in a while on the center ice package. I'd watch Hockey Night in Canada or whatever else and watch the Canucks play. And you'd see them and just marvel at the skill and the big names and, you know, and just watch them in that respect. I never really saw the sort of dirty little things that would happen out on the ice and the way that they played the game and the way a guy like Alex Burrows would operate from time to time and, you know, some of the excuse making and everything else. You didn't really see that until you got up close and saw them. So it is interesting, though. You know, it's funny how the Bruins, and I think it speaks to them on a lot of levels, come off well in a lot of these instances and the other team doesn't. You know, I think the Bruins are a fairly honest team. They're certainly physical and intimidating. But I also think they play a pretty good brand of hockey that most people respect, even if they at times know that, you know, it's going to come along with a black eye and an ice bag.
The Twitter handle you're looking for is Hacks with Hags, two G's at the end of Hags. Follow him for these playoffs. He is the man to follow for Boston Bruins hockey. Hags, we will talk to you soon, and hopefully you and I will have a beer at some point during these playoffs.
You can count on it, Wish. We will definitely have a beer. And, Merrick, you definitely need to come along, too. We'll have a couple of adult beverages.
I'm down with that. I've been known to have a little taste of the grape. I'm down. I'm down, boys. I'm good.
Sure, all right, Hags. Thanks, show, boys. See you guys.
All right, take care.
Joe Haggerty. It's our boy.
The great Joe Haggerty. I love Joe because when he does, like, he's got that Boston thing going on, so every time you interview him, it does feel like you're at a pub.
fucking Bruins. You want to flex? Yeah, we'll flex. All right, we'll show you how to flex. We'll flex. Sure. We'll play that game. All right. All right.
We had a question of the day, but we're like running long and whatever, and we'll do a couple of these tomorrow. But I wanted to end the show with an email from Slovenia.
Really?
Yes.
From Ante Kopitar's parents?
Did you have any final thoughts on the games last night or the games tonight? I mean, I think the Capitals need to win one of these two in Boston, right? Clearly.
Yep, they do. Okay. One thing from last night. Everyone's going to focus on the Dustin Penner goal. And Dustin Penner only played about 8 minutes of ice time last night, but in the at about 17:55, as we flagged it yesterday for our post-game program, about 17:55, Dustin Penner made one of the best plays of the game. Was Sammy Salo dropping in from the point, and there was Dustin Penner. Salo had like a wide open cage, and Dustin Penner, when have you ever seen Dustin Penner do this? Completely broke it up. And that saved the game last night for the Los Angeles Kings. So it was kind of poetic that it was Dustin Penner that got that goal. But how ridiculously awesome was that skate pass from Jeff Carter?
From Jeff Carter.
Like some,
oh my
yeah,
God.
Some guys would just like try to bring their stick in tight and twist their bodies around. Just like, it's like breaking sticks. Carter's like, boop, I'm just going to soccer this over to you right there.
And I was going
to
say,
gorgeous.
That feeds your Jones of the any means necessary goal scoring that has to happen around the crease, too.
And,
that's right for the playbook.
It's interesting, too, because the game opened up. Like, you always look for bookends. Like, I don't know if you're like me, Wish. Like, I don't look for differences. I look for similarities, and I look for patterns, and I look for holes. And yesterday's Vancouver-Los Angeles game was opened by a crushing body check, David Booth, on Drew Doughty, and it ended with a crushing body check, Mike Richards, on Alex Burrows. This series, folks, based on how last night went, I hope this thing goes seven. That was a fun, regardless of which team you cheer for, which team you want to win, you gotta admit, that was just a fun hockey game. And you know what?
Really
Luongo,
yeah.
Give it to Luongo, Wish, because he was excellent last night.
It was. And I thought Fleury was good, too. I didn't think he was the reason the Penguins lost. A couple things in that Penguins game. First off, on the game-winning goal, or I'm sorry, the game-tying goal by Braden Schenn, Jágr attracted three players coming into the zone. Opened up Hartnell on the wing, Hartnell cross-ice for Schenn. That is the Jágr factor. That is still a guy who's going to attract that level of attention on the ice to open things up for the rest of his team. Then the other thing was, if you want to talk about symmetry and bookends and that kind of thing, so Carter and Richards make the difference for the Kings. Right? So they make those trades. That's a whole big thing. We're getting these guys to try to become a championship team. They make the difference there. Voracek scores the game winner for Philly. Brizgalov, after looking like a space cadet in the first 20 minutes of the game, comes back, stops 15 shots, keeps them in the game in the second period. They wind up winning. Things looking pretty good for those Kings and Flyers move so far through one game.
Well, and, you know, you look at, I mean, Radulov had a pretty decent little game last night for the Nashville Predators. Pekka Rinne was an absolute beast last night for the Nashville Predators. So they're kind of swimming along. Did you think that was the one game, like even Mike Babcock said afterwards, we need to win one in Nashville. Was that the one that Detroit had to win? You know, cause now, you know, a lot of the doubts, I think, are out of Nashville's mind. And you could just see the confidence grow throughout the game. And the confidence sort of bled into a little bit of an angry cockiness. And that's what we saw, I think, with the Shea Weber, Henrik Zetterberg incident at the end of the game.
Mm-hmm.
That was Nashville saying, symbolically, we own you now, Detroit.
San Jose, St. Louis, Brian Elliott, 100% will be the backup tonight, regardless for Yaroslav Halak.
Yep.
Jonathan Toews expected back for the Blackhawks for Game 1 in Phoenix tonight. Those are your games this evening. The question that I wanted to ask you to close the show is from our friend in Slovenia. His name is Andre.
Yep.
Hi. How hard is it for a referee to call a diving embellishment penalty in the playoffs, especially in the later rounds, conference finals and Stanley Cup finals? Also, while I don't think suspension should be given out for diving, etc., wouldn't it be somewhat appropriate to give out fines for them, which would count against the salary cap if it still exists next year, obviously? All the best from Slovenia, Andre.
It's tough for officials to do that one. That's a really that's one that I think every official struggles with, because you don't know how hard the tug was, you don't know how hard the push was, you don't know how, you know, you don't and you're moving so quickly. I know it seems obvious when you're watching it on television, but watching it on television is a completely different beast than watching it at ice level, and that's one that officials, I still think to this day, wrestle with. Because you're talking about more than any other call, Wish, there you're dealing with intention. And that's such a hard thing. There are some that are really obvious, right? Like the belly flops are pretty obvious. But as we've said
Ryan
before,
Kessler breakdancing last night was pretty obvious. The dive on Richards to the point where Drew Doughty actually was on the ice making the jerk off motion as Kessler was talking to the officials, which was just beautiful.
Well, how about Kessler giving the old accidental bump to Jonathan Quick on the Alex Burrows goal? And you see how he sort of flung himself like he was being shoved, but there was no one around him other than maybe the great Gazoo, hello Dum Dum, who may have pushed him into Jonathan Quick at that moment. Like, what was that?
Wow.
Yeah, the great Gazoo just appeared.
All right. Well, there you go. There's today's show. We'll be back tomorrow. Game Show Friday, full wrap-up of tonight's games.
Hang on.
Yeah, what?
Hang on. How was your therapy today? You all right?
I feel better.
You feel better? A little better?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the irony was that I was raging about rage, wasn't I?
Well, it's like whining about whining. It's okay.
Still whining. I am Greg Wyshynski, Yahoo Sports.
Jeff Merrick, Sportsnet. Back at Hockey Central tonight, 11 o'clock and 1 a.m. as well. So it's some late nights for me for the playoffs, Wish, because I'm doing the final show every single night. So if I sound a little sleepy sometimes on the podcast, it's probably because I am.
Chris Johnston from the Canadian Press, by the way, did not expect a fine to be levied against Mike Babcock because the league says that the comments that he made about the officiating were made in the heat of the game. Boy, that's horseshit.
I do understand it, though. You know, I always thought that, you know, that bench interview during the game, or, you know, interviewing a player during the game, and it doesn't necessarily happen in the NHL, but in other sports as well, is a real sort of ticking time bomb, because you're getting players and coaches when they're in the mindset to just react to what's there. And you have to stay in that focus, and you have to hold those feelings. You can't just end of the period, okay, detach, go into interview mode. You're right in there. Like, I've always felt that that's a powder keg. And to be honest with you, Wish, I'm surprised that it hasn't happened more often. Because you have to be in that zone and in that moment for the entire period in order to get through it as a head coach or a player. I'm shocked that things like that haven't happened more often. And you know what? Players and coaches, I do give you a mulligan on that one for whatever you say.
All I know is that John Tortorella got a $30,000 fine for suggesting...
After the game.
After the game, though, I know. Cheek that NBC and the referees were working together. And Mike Babcock said last night that the officials in Game 1 against the Nashville Predators were officiating because they want to officiate in the finals. I mean, come on. Nothing?
Well, guess who was in the building?
Well, God, I know. That was...
Gary's in the building, right?
Oh, Jesus.
All he had to do was represent... Hey, see that guy up there? That's what they're auditioning for.
Yeah. Oh! It's like it's like going to detention when the principal is administering it, you know. Best behavior. All right, everybody, thank you for a wild and woolly, interesting show. It was kind of all over the place, but
therapy.
That's why we love it.
It was therapy.
It was therapy. Yeah, exactly.
A therapy podcast.
It was a Rorschach test of a show. So, thanks, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye.